They too had lived to ride away. Eddard Stark himself, and the little Crannog man, Howland Reed. He did not think it omened well that he should dream that dream again, after so many years. "You've done well, Alan," Ned was saying when Vaughan Poole returned. The steward bowed low. "His grace is without, my lord, and the queen with him." Ned pushed himself up higher, wincing as his leg trembled with pain. He had not expected Cersei to come. It did not bode well that she had. "Send them in and leave us. What we have to say should not go beyond these walls." Poole withdrew quietly. Robert had taken time to dress. He wore a black velvet doublet with a crown stag of Baratheon worked upon the breast in golden thread, and a golden mantle with a cloak of black and gold squares. A flagon of wine in his hand, his face already flushed from drink. Cersei Lannister entered behind him, a jeweled tiara in her hair. "Your grace," Ned said, "your pardons, I cannot rise." "No matter," the king said gruffly. "Some wine, eh, from the arbor, a good vintage." "A small cup," Ned said. "My head is still heavy from the milk of the puppy." "A man in your place should count himself fortunate that his head is still on his shoulders," the queen declared. "Quiet, woman," Robert snapped. He brought Ned a cup of wine. "Does the leg still pain you?" "Some," Ned said. His head was swimming, but it would not do to admit to weakness in front of the queen.
"Pycelle swears it will heal clean," Robert frowned. "I take it you know what Catelyn has done?"
"I do." Ned took a small swallow of wine. "My lady wife is blameless, your grace. All she did at my command."
"I'm not pleased, Ned," Robert grumbled.
"By what right do you dare lay hands on my blood?" Cersei demanded. "Who do you think you are?"
"The hand of the king," Ned told her with icy courtesy. "Charged by your own lord husband to keep the king's peace and enforce the king's justice."
"You were the hand of the king," Cersei began, "but now..."
"Silence!" the king roared. "You asked him a question, and he answered it."
Cersei subsided, cold with anger, and Robert turned back to Ned.
"Keep the king's peace, you say? Is that how you keep the king's peace, Ned? 7 men are dead."
8, the queen corrected. "Tregar died this morning of the blow Lord Stark gave him."
"Abductions on the king's road and drunken slaughter in the streets," the king said. "I will not have it, Ned."
"Catelyn had good reason for taking the imp."
"I said I will not have it." "To hell with her reasons. You will command her to release the dwarf at once, and you will make your peace with Jaime."
3 of my men were butchered before my eyes because Jaime Lannister wished to chase me.
Am I to forget that?"
"My brother was not the cause of the quarrel," Cersei told the king. "Lord Stark was returning drunk from a brothel. His men attacked Jaime and his guards, even as his wife attacked Tyrion on the king's road."
"You know me better than that, Robert," Ned said. "Ask Lord Baelish if you doubt me. He was there." "I've talked to Littlefinger," Robert said. "He claims he rode off to bring the gold cloaks before the fighting began, but he admits you were returning from some whorehouse."
"Some whorehouse? Damn your eyes, Robert. I went there to have a look at your daughter." "Her mother has named her Bara. She looks like that first girl you fathered, when we were boys together in the Vale." He watched the queen as he spoke. Her face was a mask, still and pale, betraying nothing. Robert flushed.
"Bara," he grumbled. "Is that supposed to please me? Damn the girl. I thought she had more sense."
"She cannot be more than 15, and a whore. And you thought she had sense?" Ned said, incredulous. His leg was beginning to pain him sorely. It was hard to keep his temper. "The fool child is in love with you, Robert." The king glanced at Cersei.
"This is no fit subject for the queen's ears."
"Her grace will have no liking for anything I have to say," Ned replied. "I am told the Kingslayer has fled the city. Give me leave to bring him back to justice." The king swirled the wine in his cup, brooding. He took a swallow.
"No," he said. "I want no more of this. Jamie slew three of your men and you five of his. Now it ends. Is that your notion of justice? Ned flared. If so, I am pleased that I am no longer your hand. The Queen looked to her husband. If any man had dared to speak to a Targaryen as he has spoken to you... Did you take me for Aerys? Robert interrupted. I took you for a king. Jaime and Tyrion are your own brothers by all the laws of marriage and the bonds we share. The Starks have driven off the one and seized the other. This man dishonors you with every breath he takes, and yet you stand there meekly asking if his leg pains him. And would he like some wine? Robert's face was dark with anger. How many times must I tell you, told your tongue, woman? Cersei's face was a study in contempt. What a jape the gods have made of us two, she said. By all rights, you ought to be in skirts, and me in mail. Purple with rage, the king lashed out, a vicious backhand blow to the side of the head. She stumbled against the table and fell hard. Yet Cersei Lannister did not cry out. Her slender fingers brushed her cheek, where the pale, smooth skin was already reddening. On the morrow, the bruise would cover half her face. I shall wear this as a badge of honor, she announced. Wear it in silence, or I'll honor you again, Robert vowed. He shouted for a guard. Sir Meryn Trant stepped into the room, tall and somber in his white armor. The queen is tired. See her to her bedchamber. The knight helped Cersei to her feet and led her out without a word. Robert reached for the flagon and refilled his cup. You see what she does to me, Ned? The king seated himself, cradling his wine cup. My loving wife, the mother of my children. The rage was gone from him now. In his eyes, Ned saw something sad and scared. I should not have hit her. That was not kingly. He stared down at his hands as if he did not quite know what they were. I was always strong. No one could stand before me, no one. How do you fight someone if you can't hit them? Confused, the king shook his head. Rhaegar won, damn him. I killed him, Ned. I drove the spike right through that black armor into his black heart, and he died at my feet. They made up songs about it, yet somehow he still won. He has Lyanna now, and I have her. The king drained his cup. Your Grace, Ned Stark said, we must talk. Robert pressed his fingertips against his temples. I'm sick unto death of talk, and the morrow I'm going to the king's wood to hunt. Whatever you have to say can wait until I return. If the guards are good, I shall not be here on your return. You commanded me to return to Winterfell, remember? Robert stood up, grasping one of the bedposts to steady himself. The guards are seldom good, Ned. Here, this is yours. He pulled the heavy silver handclasp from a pocket in the lining of his cloak and tossed it on the bed. Like it or not, you are my hand, damn you. I forbid you to leave. Ned picked up the silver clasp. He was being given no choice, it seemed. His leg throbbed, and he felt as helpless as a child. The Targaryen girl, the king groaned. Seven hells, don't start with her again. That's done. I'll hear no more of it. Why would you want me as your hand if you refuse to listen to my counsel? Why? Robert laughed. Why not? Somebody has to rule this damnable kingdom. Put on the badge, Ned. It suits you. And if you ever throw it in my face again, I swear to you, I'll pin the damn thing on Jaime Lannister. Catelyn. The eastern sky was rose and gold as the sun broke over the Vale of Arryn. Catelyn Stark watched the light spread, her hands resting on the delicate carved stone of the balustrade outside her window. Below her, the world turned from black to indigo to green as dawn crept across fields and forests. Pale white mists rose off Alyssa's tears where the ghost waters plunged over the shoulder of the mountain to begin their long tumble down the face of the giant's lance. Catelyn could feel the faint touch of spray on her face. Elissa Aaron had seen her husband, her brothers, and all her children slain, and yet in life she had never shed a tear. So in death, the gods had decreed that she would know no rest until her weeping watered the black earth of the Vale, where the men she had loved were buried. Elissa had been dead 6,000 years now, and still no drop of the torrent had ever reached the valley floor far below. Catelyn wondered how large a waterfall her own tears would make when she died. "Tell me the rest of it," she said.
"The Kingslayer is messing a host at Casterly Rock," Sir Roderick Cassel answered from the room behind her. "Your brother writes that he has sent riders to the rock demanding that Lord Tywin proclaim his intent, but he has had no answer. Edmure has commanded Lord Vance and Lord Piper to guard the pass below the Golden Tooth. He advised you that he will yield no foot of Tully land without first watering it with Lannister blood."
Catelyn turned away from the sunrise. Its beauty did little to lighten her mood. It seemed cruel for a day to dawn so fair and end so foul as this one promised to. "Edmure has sent riders and made vows," she said, "but Edmure is not the Lord of Riveron. What of my Lord Father?"
The message made no mention of Lord Hoster, my lady."
Sir Roderick tugged at his whiskers. They had grown in white as snow and bristly as a thorn bush while he was recovering from his wounds. He looked almost himself again. "My father would not have given the defense of Riveron over to Edmure unless he was very sick," she said, worried. "I should have been woken as soon as this bird arrived."
"Your lady sister thought it better to let you sleep, Maester Coleman told me."
"I should have been woken," she insisted.
"The maester tells me your sister planned to speak with you after the combat," Sir Roderick said.
"Then she still plans to go through with this mummer's farce?" Catelyn grimaced. "The dwarf has played her like a set of pipes, and she is too deaf to hear the tune. Whatever happens this morning, Sir Roderick, it is past time we took our leave. My place is at Winterfell with my sons. If you are strong enough to travel, I shall ask Lysa for an escort to see us to Gulltown. We can take ship from there."
"Another ship?"
Sir Roderick looked a shade green, yet he managed not to shudder.
"Well, as you say, my lady."
The old knight waited outside her door as Catelyn summoned the servants Lysa had given her. If she spoke to her sister before the duel, perhaps she could change her mind, she thought, as they dressed her. Lysa's policies varied with her moods, and her moods changed hourly. The shy girl she had known at Riveron had grown into a woman who was by turns proud, fearful, cruel, dreamy, reckless, timid, stubborn, vain, and above all, inconstant. When that vile turnkey of hers had come crawling to tell them that Tyrion Lannister wished to confess, Catelyn had urged Lysa to have the dwarf brought to them privately. But no, nothing would do but that her sister must make a show of him before half the Vale. And now this. "Lannister is my prisoner," she told Sir Roderick as they descended the tower steps and made their way through the eyrie's cold white halls. Catelyn wore plain grey wool with a silver belt. "My sister must be reminded of that." At the doors to Lysa's apartment, they met her uncle storming out.
"Going to join the Fool's Festival," Sir Brynden snapped. "I'd tell you to slap some sense into our sister if I'd all do any good. Bet you'd only bruise your hand."
"There was a bird from Riveron," Catelyn began. "A letter from Edmure."
"I know, child."
The black fish that fastened his cloak was Brynden's only concession to ornament.
"I had to hear it from Maester Coleman. I asked your sister for leave to take 1,000 seasoned men and ride for Riveron with all haste. Do you know what she told me? The Vale cannot spare 1,000 swords, not even one, uncle, she said. You are the knight of the gate."
Your place is here.
A gust of childish laughter drifted through the open doors behind him, and her uncle glanced darkly over his shoulder.
Well, I told her she could bloody well find herself a new knight at the gate. Blackfish or no, I'm still a Tully. I shall leave for River Run by evenfall.
Catelyn could not pretend to surprise.
Alone? You know as well as I that you will never survive the high road.
Sir Roderick and I are returning to Winterfell. Come with us, uncle. I will give you your 1,000 men. River Run will not fight alone.
Brynden thought for a moment, then nodded a brusque agreement. As you say, it's a long way home, but I'm more like to get there. I'll wait for you below.
He went striding off, his cloak swirling behind him. Catelyn exchanged a look with Sir Roderick. They went through the doors to the high, nervous sound of Child's giggles. Lysa's apartments opened over a small garden, a circle of dirt and grass planted with blue flowers and ringed on all sides by tall white towers. The builders had intended it as a god's wood, but the area rested on the hard stone of the mountain, and no matter how much soil was hauled up from the vale, they could not get a weirwood to take root here. So the lords of the area planted grass and scattered statuary amidst low flowering shrubs. It was there the two champions would meet to place their lives and that of Tyrion Lannister in the hands of the gods. Lysa, freshly scrubbed and garbed in cream velvet, with a rope of sapphires and moonstones around her milk-white neck, was holding court on the terrace, overlooking the scene of the combat, surrounded by her knights, retainers, and lords high and low. Most of them still hoped to wed her, bed her, and rule the Vale of Arryn by her side. From what Catelyn had seen during her stay at the Eyrie, it was a vain hope. A wooden platform had been built to elevate Robert's chair. There, the Lord of the Eyrie sat, giggling and clapping his hands, as a humpbacked puppeteer in blue and white motley made two wooden knights hack and slash at each other. Pitchers of thick cream and baskets of blackberries had been set out, and the guests were sipping a sweet, orange-scented wine from engraved silver cups.
A fool's festival,
Brynden had called it, and small wonder. Across the terrace, Lysa laughed gaily at some jest of Lord Hunter's and nibbled a blackberry from the point of Sir Lynn Corbray's dagger. They were the suitors who stood highest in Lysa's favour, today at least. Catelyn would have been hard-pressed to say which man was more unsuitable. Ian Hunter was even older than John Arryn had been. Half-crippled by gout and cursed with three quarrelsome sons, each more grasping than the last. Sir Lynn was a different sort of folly, lean and handsome, heir to an ancient but impoverished house, but vain, reckless, hot-tempered, and it was whispered, notoriously uninterested in the intimate charms of women. When Lysa espied Catelyn, she welcomed her with a sisterly embrace and a moist kiss on the cheek. Isn't it a lovely morning? The gods are smiling on us. Do try a cup of wine, sweet sister. Lord Hunter was kind enough to send for it from his own cellars. Thank you, no, Lysa, we must talk. After, her sister promised, already beginning to turn away from her. Now, Catelyn spoke more loudly than she intended. Men were turning to look. Lysa, you cannot mean to go ahead with this folly. Alive, the imp has value. Dead, he is only food for crows. And if his champion should prevail here...
A small chance of that, my lady,
Lord Hunter assured her, patting her shoulder with a liver-spotted hand.
Sir Varus is a doughty fighter. He'll make short work of that sellsword.
Oh, will he, my lord? Catelyn said coolly. I wonder. She had seen Bronn fight on the high road. It was no accident that he had survived the journey while other men had died. He moved like a panther, and that ugly sword of his seemed a part of his arm. Lysa's suitors were gathering around them like bees around a blossom. Women understand little of these things, Sir Morton Wainwood said. Sir Varys is a knight, sweet lady. This other fellow, well, he's sort of all cowards at heart.
useful enough in a battle with thousands of their fellows around them, but stand them up alone and the manhood leaks right out of them.
Say you have the truth of it, then, Catelyn said with a courtesy that made her mouth ache. What will we gain by the dwarf's death? Do you imagine that Jamie will care a fig that we gave his brother a trial before we flung him off a mountain?
Behead the man, Selin Corbray suggested. When the Kingslayer receives the imp's head, it will be a warning to him.
Lysa gave an impatient shake of her waist-long auburn hair. Lord Robert wants to see him fly, she said, as if that settled the matter. And the imp has only himself to blame. It was he who demanded a trial by combat.
Lady Lysa has no honourable way to deny him, even if she wished to, Lord Hunter intoned ponderously.
Ignoring them all, Catelyn turned all her force on her sister. I remind you, Tyrion Lannister is my prisoner. And I remind you, the dwarf murdered my lord husband. Her voice rose. He poisoned the hand of the king and left my sweet baby fatherless, and now I mean to see him pay. Whirling, her skirts swinging around her, Lysa stalked across the terrace. Selin and Sir Morton and the other suitors excused themselves with cool nods and trailed after her.
Do you think he did?
Sir Roderick asked her quietly when they were alone again.
Murder Lord John, that is. The imp still denies it, and most fiercely.
I believe the Lannisters murdered Lord Arryn, Catelyn replied. But whether it was Tyrion or Sir Jaime or the Queen or all of them together, I could not begin to say. Lysa had named Cersei in the letter she had sent to Winterfell, but now she seemed certain that Tyrion was the killer. Perhaps because the dwarf was here, while the Queen was safe behind the walls of the Red Keep, hundreds of leagues to the south. Catelyn almost wished she had burned her sister's letter before reading it. Sir Roderick tugged at his whiskers.
Poison? Well, that could be the dwarf's work, true enough. Or Cersei's. It is said poison is the woman's weapon. Begging your pardon, my lady. The Kingslayer now, I have no great liking for the man, but he's not the sort. Too fond of the sight of blood on that golden sword of his. Was it poison, my lady?
Catelyn frowned, vaguely uneasy. How else could they make it look a natural death? Behind her, Lord Robert shrieked with delight as one of the puppet knights sliced the other in half, spilling a flood of red sawdust onto the terrace. She glanced at her nephew and sighed. The boy is utterly without discipline. He will never be strong enough to rule unless he is taken away from his mother for a time.
His lord father agreed with you, said a voice at her elbow. She turned to behold Maester Coleman, a cup of wine in his hand. He was planning to send the boy to Dragonstone for fustering, you know. Oh, but I'm speaking out of turn.
The apple of his throat bubbed anxiously beneath the loose maester's chain.
I fear I've had too much of Lord Hunter's excellent wine. The prospect of bloodshed has my nerves all afray.
You are mistaken, maester, Catelyn said. It was Castle Rock, not Dragonstone, and those arrangements were made after the hand's death, without my sister's consent. The maester's head jerked so vigorously at the end of his absurdly long neck that he looked half a puppet himself.
No, begging your forgiveness, my lady, but it was Lord John who...
A bell tolled loudly below them. High lords and serving girls alike broke off what they were doing and moved to the balustrade. Below, two guardsmen in sky-blue cloaks led forth Tyrion Lannister. The Aerys' plump septon escorted him to the statue in the centre of the garden, a weeping woman carved in vein white marble, no doubt meant to be Alyssa.
The bad little man, Lord Robert said, giggly. Mother, can I make him fly? I want to see him fly.
Later, my sweet baby, Lysa promised.
Trial first, draw Selin Corbray, then execution.
A moment later, the two champions appeared from opposite sides of the garden. The knight was attended by two young squires, the sellsword by the Aerys' master-at-arms. Sir Vardas Egan was steel
from head to heel, encased in heavy plate armor over mail and padded surcoat. Large circular rundles, enameled cream and blue in the moon and falcon sigil of House Aaron, protected the vulnerable junction of arm and breast. A skirt of lobstered metal covered him from waist to mid-thigh, while a solid gorget encircled his throat. Falcon wings sprouted from the temples of his helm, and his visor was a pointed metal beak with a narrow slit for vision. Bronn was so lightly armored, he looked almost naked beside the knight. He wore only a shirt of black oiled ringmail over boiled leather, a round steel half-helm with a nose guard, and a mail coif. High leather boots with steel shin guards gave some protection to his legs, and discs of black iron were sewn into the fingers of his gloves. Yet Catelyn noted that the sellsword stood half a hand taller than his foe, with a longer reach, and Bronn was 15 years younger, if she was any judge. They knelt in the grass beneath the weeping woman, facing each other, with Lannister between them. The Septon removed a faceted crystal sphere from the soft cloth bag at his waist. He lifted it high above his head, and the light shattered. Rainbows danced across the imp's face. In a high, solemn, sing-song voice, the Septon asked the guards to look down and bear witness, to find the truth in this man's soul, to grant him life and freedom if he was innocent, death if he was guilty. His voice echoed off the surrounding towers. When the last echo had died away, the Septon lowered the crystal and made a hasty departure. Tyrion leaned over and whispered something in Bronn's ear before the guardsman led him away. The sellsword rose laughing and brushed a blade of grass from his knee. Robert Aaron, lord of the area and defender of the Vale, was fidgeting impatiently in his elevated chair.
"When are they going to fight?"
he asked plaintively. Sir Vardis was helped back to his feet by one of the squires. The other brought him a triangular shield, almost 4 foot tall, heavy oak, dotted with iron studs. They strapped it to his left forearm. When Lysa's master-at-arms offered Bronn a similar shield, the sellsword spat and waved it away. 3 days' growth of coarse black beard covered his jaw and cheeks, but if he did not shave, it was not for the want of a razor. The edge of his sword had the dangerous glimmer of steel that had been honed every day for hours until it was too sharp to touch. Sir Vardis held out a gauntleted hand, and his squire placed a handsome double-edged longsword in his grasp. The blade was engraved with a delicate silver tracery of a mountain sky. Its pommel was a falcon's head, its crossguard fashioned into the shape of wings. "I had that sword carved for John in King's Landing," Lysa told her guest proudly as they watched Sir Vardis try a practice cut. "He wore it whenever he sat the Iron Throne in King Robert's place. Isn't it a lovely thing? I thought it only fitting that our champion avenged John with his own blade." The engraved silver blade was beautiful beyond a doubt, but it seemed to Catelyn that Sir Vardis might have been more comfortable with his own sword. Yet she said nothing. She was weary of futile arguments with her sister.
"Make them fight,"
Lord Robert called out. Sir Vardis faced the lord of the area and lifted his sword in salute. "For the area and the Vale." Tyrion Lannister had been seated on a balcony across the garden, flanked by his guards. It was to him that Bronn turned with a cursory salute. "They await your command," Lady Lysa said to her lord son.
"Fight!"
the boy screamed, his arms trembling as they clutched at his chair. Sir Vardis swiveled, bringing up his heavy shield. Bronn turned to face him. Their swords rang together, once, twice, a testing. The sellsword backed off a step. The knight came after, holding his shield before him. He tried a slash, but Bronn jerked back just out of reach, and the silver blade cut only air. Bronn circled to his right. Sir Vardis turned to follow, keeping his shield between them.
The knight pressed forward, placing each foot carefully on the uneven ground. The sellsword gave way, a faint smile playing over his lips. Sir Vardus attacked, slashing, but Bronn leapt away from him, hopping lightly over a low, moss-covered stone. Now the sellsword circled left, away from the shield, towards the knight's unprotected side. Sir Vardus tried a hack at his legs, but did not have the reach. Bronn danced farther to his left. Sir Vardus turned in place. "The man is craven," Lord Hunter declared. "Stand and fight, coward." Other voices echoed the sentiment. Catelyn looked at Sir Roderick. Her master-at-arms gave a curt shake of his head.
"He wants to make Sir Vardus chase him. The weight of armor and shield would tire even the strongest man."
She had seen men practice at their sword play near every day of her life, had viewed 50 tourneys in her time, but this was something different and deadlier. A dance where the smallest misstep meant death. And as she watched, the memory of another duel in another time came back to Catelyn Stark, as vivid as if it had been yesterday. They met in the lower bailey of Riverrun. When Brandon saw that Petar wore only helm and breastplate and mail, he took off most of his armor. Petar had begged her for a favor he might wear, but she had turned him away. Her lord father promised her to Brandon Stark, and so it was to him that she gave her token, a pale blue handscarf she had embroidered with the leaping trout of Riverrun. As she pressed it into his hand, she pleaded with him. "He is only a foolish boy, but I have loved him like a brother, and it would grieve me to see him die." And her betrothed looked at her with the cool gray eyes of a Stark and promised to spare the boy who loved her. That fight was over almost as soon as it began. Brandon was a man grown, and he drove Littlefinger all the way across the bailey and down the water stair, raining steel on him with every step, until the boy was staggering and bleeding from a dozen wounds. "Yield," he called more than once, but Petar would only shake his head and fight on grimly. When the river was lapping at their ankles, Brandon finally ended it with a brutal backhand cut that bit through Petar's rings and leather into the soft flesh below the ribs, so deep that Catelyn was certain that the wound was mortal. He looked at her as he fell and murmured, "Cat," as the bright blood came flowing out between his mailed fingers. She thought she had forgotten it. That was the last time she had seen his face, until the day she was brought before him in King's Landing. A fortnight passed before Littlefinger was strong enough to leave Riverrun, but her lord father forbade her to visit him in the tower where he lay abed. Lysa helped their maester nurse him. She had been softer and shyer in those days. Edmure had called on him as well, but Petar had sent him away. Her brother had acted as Brandon's squire at the duel, and Littlefinger would not forgive that. As soon as he was strong enough to be moved, Lord Huster Tully sent Petar Baelish away in a closed litter to finish his healing on the fingers upon the windswept jut of rock where he'd been born. The ringing clash of steel on steel jarred Catelyn back to the present. Sir Vardus was coming hard at Bronn, driving into him with shield and sword. The sellsword scrambled backward, checking each blow, stepping lithely over rock and root, his eyes never leaving his foe. He was quicker, Catelyn saw. The knight's silvered sword never came near to touching him, but his own ugly grey blade hacked a nut from Sir Vardus' shoulder plate. The brief flurry of fighting ended as swiftly as it had begun, when Bronn sidestepped and slid behind the statue of the weeping woman. Sir Vardus lunged at where he had been, striking a spark off the pale marble of Alyssa's thigh.
"They're not fighting good, mother," the Lord of the Eyrie complained. "I want them to fight."
"They will, sweet baby," his mother soothed him. "The sellsword can't run all day." Some of the lords on Lysa's terrace were making wry jests as they refilled their wine cups, but across the garden, Tyrion Lannister's mismatched eyes watched the champions dance as if there were nothing else in the world. Bronn came out from behind the statue, hard and fast, still moving left, aiming a two-handed cut at the knight's unshielded right side. Sir Vardis blocked, but clumsily, and the sellsword's blade flashed upwards at his head. Metal rang, and a falcon's wing collapsed with a crunch. Sir Vardis took a half-step back to brace himself, raised his shield. Oak chips flew as Bronn's sword hacked at the wooden wall. The sellsword stepped left again, away from the shield, and caught Sir Vardis across the stomach, the razor edge of his blade leaving a bright gash where it bit into the knight's plate. Sir Vardis drove forward off his back foot, his own silver blade descending in a savage arc. Bronn slammed it aside and danced away. The knight crashed into the weeping woman, rocking her on her plinth. Staggered, he stepped backward, his head turning this way and that as he searched for his foe. The slit visor of his helm narrowed his vision. "Behind you, sir!" Lord Hunter shouted too late. Bronn brought his sword down with both hands, catching Sir Vardis in the elbow of his sword arm. The thin lobstered metal that protected the joint crunched. The knight groaned, turning, wrenching his weapon up. This time, Bronn stood his ground. The swords flew at each other, and their steel song filled the garden and rang off the white towers of the Eyrie.
"Sir Vardis is hurt,"
Sir Roderick said, his voice grave. Catelyn did not need to be told. She had eyes. She could see the bright finger of blood running along the knight's forearm, the wetness inside the elbow joint. Every parry was a little slower and a little lower than the one before. Sir Vardis turned his side to his foe, trying to use his shield to block instead, but Bronn slid around him, quick as a cat. The sellsword seemed to be getting stronger. His cuts were leaving their marks now. Deep, shiny gashes gleamed all over the knight's armor. On his right thigh, his beaked visor, crossing on his breastplate, a long one along the front of his gorget. The moon and falcon rondel over Sir Vardis's right arm was sheared clean in half, hanging by its strap. They could hear his labored breath rattling through the air holes in his visor. Blind with arrogance as they were, even the knights and lords of the Vale could see what was happening below them. Yet her sister could not. "Enough, Sir Vardis," Lady Lysa called down. "Finish him now. My baby is growing tired." And it must be said of Sir Vardis Egan, he was true to his lady's command, even to the last. One moment he was reeling backward, half crouched behind his scarred shield. The next he charged. The sudden bull rush caught Bronn off balance. Sir Vardis crashed into him and slammed the lip of his shield into the sellsword's face. Almost, Bronn lost his feet. He staggered back, tripped over a rock, and caught hold of the weeping woman to keep his balance. Throwing aside his shield, Sir Vardis lurched after him, using both hands to raise his sword. His right arm was blood from elbow to fingers now. Yet his last desperate blow would have opened Bronn from neck to navel if the sellsword had stood to receive it. But Bronn jerked back. John Arryn's beautiful engraved silver sword glanced off the marble elbow of the weeping woman and snapped, clean a third of the way up the blade. Bronn put his shoulder into the statue's back. The weathered likeness of Alyssa Arryn tottered and fell with a great crash, and Sir Vardis Egan went down beneath her. Bronn was on him in a heartbeat, kicking what was left of his shattered rondel aside to expose the weak spot between arm and breastplate. Sir Vardis was lying on his side, pinned beneath the broken torso of the weeping woman. Catelyn heard the knight groan as the sellsword lifted his blade with both hands and drove it down and in with all his weight behind it, under the arm and through the ribs. Sir Vardis Egan shuddered and lay still. Silence fell over the Eyrie. Bronn yanked off his half helm and let it fall to the grass. His lip was smashed and bloody where the shield had caught him,
and his coal black hair was soaked with sweat. He spit out a broken tooth.
Is it over, Mother?
The Lord of the Airy asked. No, Catelyn wanted to tell him. It's only now beginning. Yes, Lysa said glumly, her voice as cold and dead as the captain of her guard.
Can I make the little man fly now?
Across the garden, Tyrion Lannister got to his feet.
Not this little man, he said. This little man is going down in the turnipoist. Thank you very much.
You presume, Lysa began.
I presume that House Arryn remembers its own words,
the imp said.
As high as honor. You promised I could make him fly,
the Lord of the Airy screamed at his mother. He began to shake. Lady Lysa's face was flushed with fury. The gods have seen fit to proclaim him innocent, child. We have no choice but to free him. She lifted her voice. Guards, take my Lord of Lannister and his creature here out of my sight. Escort them to the bloody gate and set them free. See that they have horses and supplies sufficient to reach the Trident, and make certain all their goods and weapons are returned to them. They shall have need of them. On the high road?
The high road,
Tyrion Lannister said. Lysa allowed herself a faint, satisfied smile. It was another sort of death sentence, Catelyn realized. Tyrion Lannister must know that as well, yet the dwarf favored Lady Arryn with a mocking bow.
As you command, my lady, he said. I believe we know the way.
John.
You are as hopeless as any boys I've ever trained,
Sir Alistair Thorne announced when they had all assembled in the yard.
Your hands were made for manure shovels, not for swords. And if it was up to me, the lot of you would be sent to herd and swine. But last night, I was told that Gurin is marching 5 new boys up the King's Road. One or two may even be worth the price of piss. To make room for them, I have decided to pass 8 of you onto the Lord Commander to do with as he will.
He called out the names one by one.
Toad, Stonehead, Oryx, Lover, Pimple, Monkey, Saloon.
Last of all, he looked at John.
And the Bastard.
Pip let fly a whoop and thrust his sword in the air. Sir Alistair fixed him with a reptile stare.
They will call you men of the Night's Watch now, but you are bigger fools than the mummer's monkey here, if you believe that. You are boys still, green and stinking of summer. And when the winter comes, you will die like flies.
And with that, Sir Alistair Thorne took his leave of them. The other boys gathered round the 8 who had been named, laughing and cursing and offering congratulations. Haldor smacked Toad on the butt with the flat of his sword and shouted,
Toad of the Night's Watch!
Yelling that a black brother needed a horse, Pip leapt onto Gren's shoulders and they tumbled to the ground rolling and punching and hooting. Darien dashed inside the armory and returned with a skin of sour red. As they passed the wine from hand to hand, grinning like fools, John noticed Samuel Tarly standing by himself beneath a bare, dead tree in the corner of the yard. John offered him the skin. A swallow of wine? Sam shook his head.
No, thank you, John.
Are you well?
Very well, truly, the fat boy lied. I am so happy for you all.
His round face quivered as he forced a smile.
You will be First Ranger some day, just as your uncle was.
Is, John corrected. He would not accept that Benjen Stark was dead. Before he could say more, Haldor cried, Here, you planning to drink that all yourself? Pip snatched the skin from his hand and danced away laughing. While Gren seized his arm, Pip gave the skin a squeeze and a thin stream of red squirted John in the face. Halder howled in protest at the waste of good wine. John sputtered and struggled. Matha and Jerin climbed the wall and began pelting them all with snowballs. By the time he wrenched free, with snow in his hair and wine stains on his surcoat, Samuel Tarly had gone. That night, Three Finger Hub cooked the boys a special meal to mark the occasion. When John arrived at the common hall, the Lord Steward himself led him to the bench near the fire. The older men clapped him on the arm in passing. The eight soon-to-be brothers feasted on rack of lamb baked in a crust of garlic and herbs, garnished with sprigs of mint, and surrounded by mashed yellow turnips swimming in butter. "From the Lord Commander's own table," Bowen Marsh told them. There were salads of spinach and chickpeas and turnip greens, and afterwards bowls of iced blueberries and sweet cream. "Do you think they'll keep us together?" Pip wondered as they gorged themselves happily. Toad made a face.
"I hope not. I'm sick of looking at those ears of yours."
"Ho," said Pip, "listen to the crow called a raven black. You're certain to be a ranger, Toad. They'll want you as far from the castle as they can. If Mance Raider attacks, lift your visor and show your face and he'll run off screaming."
Everyone laughed but Gren. "I hope I'm a ranger."
"You and everyone else," said Matha.
Every man who wore the black walked the wall, and every man was expected to take up steel in its defense. But the rangers were the true fighting heart of the Night's Watch. It was they who dared to ride beyond the wall, sweeping through the haunted forest and the icy mountain heights west of the Shadow Tower, fighting wildlings and giants and monstrous snow bears.
"Not everyone," said Halder. "It's the builders for me. What use would rangers be if the wall fell down?"
The Order of Builders provided the masons and carpenters to repair keeps and towers, the miners to dig tunnels and crush stone for roads and footpaths, the woodsmen to clear away new growth wherever the forest pressed too close to the wall. Once, it was said, they had quarried immense blocks of ice from frozen lakes deep in the haunted forest, dragged them south on sledges so the wall might be raised even higher. Those days were centuries gone, however. Now it was all they could do to ride the wall from East Watch to the Shadow Tower, watching for cracks or signs of melt or making what repairs they could. "The old bear's no fool," Darien observed. "You're certain to be a builder, and John's certain to be a ranger. He's the best sworn and the best rider among us, and his uncle was the first before he..." His voice trailed off awkwardly as he realized what he had almost said. "Benjamin Stark is still first ranger," John Snow told him, toying with his bowl of blueberries. The rest might have given up all hope of his uncle's safe return, but not him. He pushed away the berries, scarcely touched, and rose from the bench.
"Aren't you going to eat those?"
Toad asked. "They're yours." John had hardly tasted Hub's great feast. "I could not eat another bite." He took his cloak from his hook near the door and shouldered his way out. Pip followed him.
"John, what is it?"
"Sam," he admitted. "He was not at table tonight."
"It's not like him to miss a meal," Pip said thoughtfully. "Do you suppose he's taken ill?"
"He's frightened. We're leaving him." He remembered the day he had left Winterfell, all the bittersweet farewells, Bran lying broken, Rob with snow in his hair, Arya raining kisses on him after he'd given her needle. Once we say our words, we all have duties to attend to. Some of us may be sent away to Eastwatch or the Shadow Tower. Sam will remain in training with the likes of Rast and Cougar and all these new boys who are coming up the King's Road. God only knows what they will be like, but you can bet Sir Alistair will send them against him first chance he gets. Pip made a grimace.
"You did all you could."
"All we could. Wasn't enough," John said. A deep restlessness was on him as he went back to Harden's Tower for Ghost.
The direwolf walked beside him to the stables. Some of the more skittish horses kicked at their stalls and laid back their ears as they entered. John saddled his mare, mounted, and rode out from Castle Black, south across the moonlit night. Ghost raced ahead of him, flying over the ground, gone in the blink of an eye. John let him go. A wolf needed to hunt. He had no destination in mind. He only wanted to ride. He followed the creek for a time, listening to the icy trickle of water over the rocks, then cut across the fields to the King's Road. It stretched out before him, narrow and stony and pocked with weeds. A road of no particular promise, yet the sight of it filled John Snow with a vast longing. Winterfell was down that road, and beyond it, River Run and King's Landing, and the Eyrie and so many other places. Casterly Rock, the Isles of Faces, the Red Mountains of Dawn, the Hundred Islands of Bravos in the sea, the smoking ruins of old Valyria, all the places John would never see. The world was down that road, and he was here. Once he swore his vow, the wall would be his home until he was as old as Maester Aemon. "I'm not sworn yet," he muttered. He was no outlaw, bound to take the black or pay the penalty for his crimes. He had come here freely, and he might leave freely until he said the words. He need only ride on, and he could leave it all behind. By the time the moon was full again, he would be back in Winterfell with his brothers. "Your half-brothers," a voice inside him reminded him, "and Lady Stark, who will not welcome you." There was no place for him in Winterfell, no place in King's Landing either. Even his own mother had not had a place for him. The thought of her made him sad. He wondered who she had been, what she looked like, why his father had left her. Because she was a whore or an adulterous fool, something dark and dishonorable. Or else, why was Lord Eddard too ashamed to speak of her? Jon Snow turned away from the King's Road to look behind him. The fires of Castle Black were hidden behind a hill, but the wall was there, pale beneath the moon, vast and cold, running from horizon to horizon. He wheeled his horse around and started for home. Ghost returned as he crested a rise and saw the distant glow of lamplight from the Lord Commander's tower. The direwolf's muzzle was red with blood as he trotted beside the horse. John found himself thinking of Samwell Tarly again on the ride back. By the time he reached the stables, he knew what he must do. Maester Aemon's apartments were in a stout wooden keep below the rookery. Aged and frail, the maester shared his chambers with two of the younger stewards, who tended to his needs and helped him in his duties. The brothers joked that he had been given the two ugliest men in the night's watch. Being blind, he was spared having to look at them. Clydus was short, bald, and chinless, with small pink eyes like a mole. Chet had a wen on his neck, the size of a pigeon's egg, and a face red with boils and pimples. Perhaps that was why he always seemed so angry. It was Chet who answered John's knock. "I need to speak to Maester Aemon," John told him. "The maester is abed, as you should be. Come back on the morrow, and maybe he'll see you." He began to shut the door. John jammed it open with his boot. "I need to speak to him now. The morning will be too late." Chet scowled. "The maester is not accustomed to being woken in the night. Do you know how old he is?" "Old enough to treat visitors with more courtesy than you," John said. "Give him my pardons. I would not disturb his rest if it were not important. And if I refuse?" John had his boot wedged solidly in the door. "I can stand here all night if I must." The black brother made a disgusted noise and opened the door to admit him. "Wait in the library. There's wood stutter fire. I won't have the maester catching a chill on account of you." John had the logs crackling merrily by the time Chet
led in Maester Aemon. The old man was clad in his bedrobe, but round his throat was the chain collar of his order. A maester did not remove it even to sleep.
"The chair beside the fire would be pleasant,"
he said, when he felt the warmth on his face. When he was seated comfortably, Chet covered his legs with a fur and went to stand by the door. "I'm sorry to have woken you, Maester," Jon Snow said.
"You did not wake me,"
Maester Aemon replied.
"I find I need less sleep as I grow older, and I'm grown very old. I often spend half the night with ghosts, remembering times 50 years past, as if it were yesterday. The mystery of a midnight visitor is a welcome diversion. So tell me, Jon Snow, why have you come calling at this strange hour?"
"To ask that Samwell Tarly be taken from training and accepted as a brother of the Night's Watch." "This is no concern of Maester Aemon's," Chet complained.
"Our Lord Commander has given the training of recruits into the hands of Sir Alistair Thorne,"
the maester said gently.
"Only he may say when a boy is ready to swear his vows, as you surely know. Why then come to me?"
"The Lord Commander listens to you," Jon told him, "and the wounded and the sick of the Night's Watch are in your charge."
"And is your friend Samwell wounded or sick?"
"He will be," Jon promised, "unless you help." He told them all of it, even the part where he'd set ghosts at Rest's throat. Maester Aemon listened silently, blind eyes fixed on the fire, but Chet's face darkened with each word. "Without us to keep him safe, Sam will have no chance," Jon finished. "He's hopeless with a sword. My sister Arya could tear him apart, and she's not yet 10. If Sir Alistair makes him fight, it's only a matter of time before he's hurt or killed." Chet could stand no more. "I've seen this fat boy in the common hall," he said. "He is a pig and a hopeless craven as well, if what you see is true."
"Maybe it is so," Maester Aemon said. "Tell me, Chet, what would you have us do with such a boy?"
"Leave him where he is," Chet said. "The wall is no place for the weak. Let him train until he's ready, no matter how many years that takes. Sir Alistair shall make a man of him or kill him as the gods will." "That's stupid," Jon said. He took a deep breath to gather his thoughts. "I remember once I asked Maester Luin why he wore a chain around his throat." Maester Aemon touched his own collar lightly, his bony, wrinkled fingers stroking the heavy metal links.
"Go on."
"He told me that a maester's collar is made of chain to remind him that he has sworn to serve," Jon said, remembering. "I asked why each link was a different metal. A silver chain would look much finer with his grey robes," I said. Maester Luin laughed. "A maester forges his chain with study," he told me. "The different metals are each a different kind of learning. Gold for the study of money and accounts, silver for healing, iron for warcraft." And he said there were other meanings as well. The collar is supposed to remind a maester of the realm he serves. Isn't that so? Lords are gold and knights steel, but two links can't make a chain. You also need silver and iron and lead, tin and copper and bronze and all the rest. And those are farmers and smiths and merchants and the like. A chain needs all sorts of metals, and a land needs all sorts of people. Maester Aemon smiled.
"And so?"
"The Night's Watch needs all sorts too. Why else have rangers and stewards and builders? Lord Randall couldn't make Sam a warrior, and Sir Alistair won't either. You can't hammer tin into iron, no matter how hard you beat it. But that doesn't mean tin is useless. Why shouldn't Sam be a steward?" Chet gave an angry scowl. "I'm a steward. You think it's easy work? Fit for cowards? The Order of Stewards keeps the watch alive.
We hunt and farm, tend the horses, milk the cows, gather firewood, cook the meals. Who do you think makes your clothing? Who brings up supplies from the south? The Stuarts.
Maester Aemon was gentler.
Is your friend a hunter?
He hates hunting, John had to admit.